Thank you. I think I have my own microphone. So, very good. So we'll see. We can. So I am at the Berkeley Lab, and as I said, I've worked with John and Peter for many years. One of the things we do have there is a large supercomputer, and it's been my privilege to use that in a number of instances, plus some other highly parallel computing facilities, and doing some calculations that have discovered some new mathematical facts in some, I think, very interesting ways. A lot of the stuff that I've been involved with John and Peter has been what we might describe as high-precision arithmetic. And in many cases, it's both high-performance computing and high-performance or high-precision arithmetic. So what do we mean here? We mean where we're computing with more than just the usual machine precision. There are actually quite a few applications, even in rather conventional physics and scientific computations. And we're seeing quite a few examples, even in these traditional sort of physical sciences computations, where high-precision arithmetic is necessary. I think it's a point here. Some people will say, but that you could get away without using high-precision arithmetic if you were to use this algorithm instead of this one, which is a little bit more numerically well-behaved. But I would argue, actually, that in a lot of these large scientific codes, it's just easier to, if it's just one part of the computation that needs to be done to higher precision, to just do that rather than trying to substitute a whole different algorithmic approach, which may be numerically superior, but would be a lot more effort and a lot more possibility for error to implement. So even in these examples, I think high-precision arithmetic is often the way to go. Here's what we mean by high-precision arithmetic. We have the typical precision of about 64 bits and 80 bits on some Intel processors. There's a 128-bit standard that's been defined by the IEEE, but essentially nobody has implemented it in hardware, so it's sort of like a tree falling in the forest that no one hears. Fortunately, there is a lot of software that's available now, and in many cases it's free, and you can write your own programs like in C or C++ and connect to high-precision software. We actually have some of that software available on our own website here. There's this QD package that would do arithmetic up to, say, with twice the normal precision or four times the normal precision, up to about like 64 digits. Beyond that, then there are arbitrary precision package that's available. And both of these you can use by just taking an existing code that's already working with normal precision, and just by making a few changes to your code, you can engage these high precision routines so that the conversion is much more painless and much more likely to actually be bug free. So anyway, what do we do with this? We've mentioned some of these real-world scientific applications here. And again, this is just a few of many that we could list. One of these you're probably familiar with, that if you're doing long-term studies of the simulations of the solar system, this has to be done using high-precision arithmetic, or inevitably it gets off kilter at certain places where there are interactions between planets. But I think most of what we're going to talk from the remaining here are some applications of high precision in experimental mathematics. This is really where we've hit the pay dirt, say, in the last 5 to 10 years. And so basically the approach here is that we develop numerical ways to calculate various mathematical entities. These are values of functions, limits of sequences, definite integrals, anything of this sort, anything where that's amenable to a computation. And then we compute these to high precision, and not just, again, 10 or 15 digits, but in many cases, 500 or 1,000 digits accuracy. And then we ask various tools to try and identify these numerical values as given by certain mathematical formulas. And in many cases, this is successful and has led to completely out-of-the-blue discoveries of mathematical facts and formulas that we didn't previously know existed. And there were many other cases of help confirm analytically derived results and to make sure that we're on the right track. Here we go. So I'd say the key tool, in addition to the high precision arithmetic here, is this PSLQ integer relation algorithm that we found very, very useful in many contexts. And so what the PSLQ does is it just solves this very simple problem. If someone gives you a list of n real numbers, specified, say, to high precision, and then ask, is there some integer linear combination of these numbers that's zero? Or in other words, is there some simple integer linear relationship that underlies these numbers? At the present time, this PSLQ algorithm is the best known scheme, although there are other schemes such as the LLL algorithm that are often used. This PSLQ was actually found originally by Helam and Ferguson, who's now better known for a lot of mathematical sculptures. Maybe some of you have seen some of these. These are often very large, either of granite or bronze, and often very striking sculptures on mathematical themes. As I once teased him that he was becoming more famous now for his sculpture than his mathematics, and he readily agreed that this is true. But nonetheless, he is the person. Is certainly his mathematical claim to fame is as the discovery of this PSLQ algorithm. So what does PSLQ do? Given this input vector X, it constructs a sequence of integer-valued matrices, B sub n, such that the matrix or the vector matrix product X times B sub n is a vector Y which has small entries. And the idea is that as the algorithm proceeds, these entries of Y get smaller and smaller and smaller in a fairly uniform fashion until one of the entries is zero. And that means that we have we found an integer relation from the original X vector, and the corresponding column of that matrix B sub n that gives the zero in Y is the relation that we're seeking. So one thing that's true for PSLQ or any integer relation algorithm, though, is it requires very high precision. It's pretty easy to see that if you have if there exists an integer relation, say of length n, vector length n, and the coefficients, say, have maximum size d digits, then you have no hope of finding that relation unless all of your input data and your computations are done to at least n times d digit precision. So, you know, just do the arithmetic. It's simple. If there's a relation involving 10 terms, say, with coefficients, say, up to size 20 digits in size, then all of your input data had better be to 200 digit precision, or the real relation will be lost in a sea of meaningless numerical artifacts. So here's just one example. As it turns out, this is an example of an actual run of this PSLQ algorithm that discovered a very remarkable result that we'll mention later in the talk. And so it started out here, if you look at the minimum of the entries of that y vector, which is sort of the product of the x times the b sub n's. And we start here at the iteration 1, and it was like with about 10 to the minus 4 was the smallest entry, and then that starts as the algorithm proceeds. After about iteration 50, it's what, down to about 10 to the minus 10. Eventually, of 150, it's up to about 10 to the minus 40. And then abruptly, at iteration 199, that minimum y value abruptly drops about 200 orders of magnitude to roughly 10 to the minus 250. And we were using 250-digit arithmetic, i.e., this had dropped to what is numerically zero. And that's our clue that we really did the size, this very, very sharp drop over 200 orders of magnitude. That's our clue that we really did find some underlying real mathematical fact, and not just, this is not just a numerical noise. And in general, this is sort of what we do in running PSLQ. We look for this very abrupt drop when the relation is found. Otherwise, we don't think that we have numerically reliable results, and we have to compute everything to higher precision or try different possible terms in the relation. So anyway, this is the overall strategy for using PSLQ to discover some new numerical or some new mathematical relation. We suppose like we have some constant alpha, and we have a suspicion that it may satisfy a formula involving certain terms. And it may well be the first time we approach this problem, we may be just completely guessing out of the blue as to what these terms, and we've done that sometimes. We put everything in the, including the kitchen sink, on the right-hand side of the relation. We have pi and e and square root of 2 and, you know, the log of 1 plus the square root of 3 and some other sort of common terms that we often see in this type of problem. And so what we have to do, you first have to compute alpha to high precision, and we're talking like several hundred digits typically. And this may be, in fact, in most applications, most of these studies, that is the most computationally expensive part by far, is to compute that alpha to high precision. Then you compute the other terms to high precision and run PSLQ and hope that you find something. One thing that we also can do is if we suspect that alpha is an algebraic number, we can directly test that hypothesis. Say if we suspected it's algebraic, say of degree 30. So what you do is you compute this vector, 1, alpha, alpha squared, alpha cubed, up to alpha to the n for some n. And again, computing all of this to high precision, typically several hundred digit accuracy, and then run PSLQ on this algorithm. Because if PSLQ finds a relation among those input numbers, well, that relation is precisely the set of coefficients that alpha satisfies. Because that's the, in other words, those would be the coefficients that would be attached to each of the powers, respective powers of alpha. So again, and we mentioned here that the importance when it runs, we look like for a very sharp drop in the minimum y vector, and that's our clue that we really have found something. So when I was first talking about integer relations, giving some talks, and I showed, for instance, how that you could find like an algebraic, you could find the coefficients of the minimum polynomial of some algebraic number, and someone at the end of the lecture raised this impertinent question. They said, well, this is very interesting, Bailey, but have you ever actually found something using this integer relation algorithm that you didn't already know was there? And I had to say no, we hadn't. This, it's a sort of a tool in search of a problem. And not long after that, actually, Ferguson and I did really find something that wasn't previously known. And that was the following. We were looking at this problem that comes up in chaos theory that maybe many of you are already familiar with, called the logistic iteration. And so if you start with, pick any starting value, say between 0 and 1, then you perform this iteration here. Depending on the value of that R, this iteration has different properties. If R is less than 3, this iteration will very quickly converge to a single limit value. When it's a little bit bigger, then it starts oscillating between two values that look like essentially two limit points of this sequence. If R is a little bit larger, about 3.5, then it starts circling between 5 or 4 limit points, and then 8, and then 16, and eventually it becomes completely chaotic without even any quasi-periodicity. And so Ferguson and I were looking at this bifurcation point here, in other words, the value of R, where this iteration switches from being 4-way periodic to 8-way periodic. And just using a very simple sort of binary search scheme, I was able to compute that value. Here's like about 100 digits. I actually computed several hundred digits of this value. And so when we were running actually a predecessor to PSLQ, it immediately came back and found and said that it satisfied this relation. This is the polynomial that value satisfied. And so then subsequently we're actually able to prove that. In fact, now it can be proven quite easily using Maple or Mathematica. So, I might mention that more recently, David Broadhurst looked at the transition between 8-way periodicity and 16-way periodicity. This turned out to be a very, very much more difficult problem. But nonetheless, doing a very large computation involving a highly parallel computer, we were able to find that value. And using about 10,000 digit arithmetic. And as it turns out that satisfies a polynomial of degree 240. But by making a certain transformation, we were actually able to discover it as a relation of degree 120. But anyway, that was a much more difficult problem, and I think going even one step further is beyond what we can do now. Although again, Moore's law is advancing. Someday soon, we will be able to go an additional step further. So many of you are familiar with this BBP formula for pi, and this is perhaps the best known of the discoveries made using PSLQ. This goes back 12 years now. Peter Borwein here and also Simon Plouffe were looking at this question of whether it is possible for any of the various well-known mathematical constants for us to jump out into their like decimal or binary expansion and just compute digits, say, beginning, say, at the millionth position? Or is there any shortcut to doing that, or is it fundamentally not really possible? We really got to compute the whole constant to that, to million plus digit precision. And quite surprisingly, they found initially a very simple scheme for doing this for the binary digits of the natural log of 2. And this relied on a very simple, well-known formula for log 2. It's been known since the days of Euler. And so they immediately began to search, are there other constants that have infinite series formulas of that type, in which case they also would share this property. In particular, are there any such formulas for pi? And at the time, none were known. In fact, Peter and others were furiously searching the literature, and no formulas of this type were known. So, and quite frankly, as I understand it, there was some skepticism that, you know, that there would be such a formula, because, you know, if there were such one, surely Euler or Gauss or Ramanujan would have found it. So, what's the point of even looking? But, so before giving up, they did the following. They took the list of constants that they had already found that had this property. They computed them to high precision, computed pi to high precision. Again, I think it was roughly 200-digit accuracy. And then looked for, applied PSLQ, one of the PSLQ programs that I had written, and then looked for integer relations. Because if they found one, all they need to do is solve for pi, and that would give them a formula of this type for pi. And so initially these attempts were not successful, but at some point after several months of work, they added a couple more constants to the list, and they again ran the PSLQ, and it found the relation. And when they sorted it out, this is the formula that resulted. And it does have this the required property that you can compute it to, using a very simple computational scheme to calculate binary or base 16 digits of pi beginning at an arbitrary starting point without having to compute any of the digits that came before. And in fact, this has been used recently, or it was actually several years, about eight years ago now? Colin Percival computed, using a worldwide network of computers, calculated binary digits of pi beginning at the 1/4,000,000,000th position. In other words, the 10 to the 15th position. And again, using a variant of this formula. And so, but anyway, but the point of this is, this formula was discovered by PSLQ. It was probably the first example of a formula for pi that was found by a computer. So, or I might mention that immediately after this, people were furiously searching by computer and otherwise for formulas of this type that would have, say, a 10 in the denominator there instead of 16, because that would allow us to do the same trick for base 10 digits, or for any, you know, anything else besides a power of 2 here. In other words, like base 3 digits or base 5 digits. Alas, none of these searches were successful. And just a few years ago, John Borween and Will Galway and David Borween, who's John and Peter's father, they mercifully put an end to these searches by proving that there really are no such formulas of that type for pi, except for the ones that are already known that are of base 2. So nonetheless, like for instance for pi squared, here are some other formulas, just a few of many, many that have been subsequently discovered, various constants of this type. They all have this digit calculating property. Here are two such formulas for pi squared. That were also calculated, again, that were also calculated by PSLQ. The first one there permits you to calculate base 2 digits of pi squared beginning in an arbitrary position. The second one permits you to calculate base 3 digits of pi squared beginning in an arbitrary position. So, and again, and you're welcome to look at this compendium that we have on the website there. It was initially thought that, you know, that this is very interesting, although not of any, these results were sort of interesting, but not really of any deep mathematical significance. However, more recently, it was shown that the existence of these formulas has relevance to this age-old question of whether and why the digits of pi are random. And in particular, a result of Richard Crandall and myself is that the question of whether the natural log of 2 is normal in this sense in other words, we define a number to be normal, meaning that let's say take 10, base 10, for instance. A number is 10 normal if every single digit, all of the 10 digits, appear in the limit with frequency exactly 1/10, and then all pairs of digits appear with exactly frequency 1/100th, all triples, every triple, all 1,000 of them, appear with limiting frequency 1/1,000th, and so on. Every string of m digits appears with limiting frequency 10 to the minus m. If all of those conditions are simultaneously met, then we would say that that number is 10 normal. You might ask, well, are there any 10 normal numbers? But it's easy to show by measure theory that, in fact, almost all real numbers are 10 normal. And the same thing applies, of course, to other number bases. But anyway, what we showed here is that the natural log of 2 is 2 normal if and only if this very, very simple iteration here, essentially a random number generator type iteration, is equidistributed in the unit interval. And then pi is 2 normal, or equivalently 16 normal, if and only if this unlikely looking iteration near the bottom here is equidistributed in the unit interval. So we hope that's at least some progress on this question. And then pushing these methods even further, we were actually able to prove normality unconditionally for a whole class of numbers, one of which, to say the simplest of which, is this constant here that we call alpha 2,3. So in other words, if we look at the binary or base 16 digits of this number, here's the first about 50 base 16 digits. That base 16 expansion is provably normal. So in other words, the entire works of William Shakespeare are included somewhere and actually appear end to end without any errors somewhere in the expansion of this number. Oh my gosh, is there a bug there? There is. Yes. In the top line, that should be, in the denominator, should be 3 to the n times 2 to the 3 to the n. Yeah, there's a bug. Yeah, it's better. It's correct down on the below there. Thanks, John. So anyway, interesting. And then further, as we indicate below here, we actually able to similarly prove this for an uncountably infinite family of numbers. In other words, here's an uncountably infinite family of explicitly given constants that are provably two normal and transcendental. So, you know, unfortunately, you might say, well, is pi one of these? Probably not, but hey, you know, one step at a time. So anyway, again, just getting back to some of the applications of PSOQ, where one area that, in addition to some that that John had mentioned, that we found is particularly fruitful is in the area of evaluating definite integrals. Now, I don't know about you, but I must be one of the very few students that I actually enjoyed doing integrals. I thought it was just good fun. If I needed some amusement when I was young, I'd solve an integral just for amusement. So here I am, a grown man, and still doing integrals. I should be ashamed of myself. So anyway, the main problem as we first started to look at this is simply the evaluating an integral to high precision. This is not easy. And we, after just doing a sort of a survey of some of the available techniques, we quickly discovered that most of them run out of steam pretty easily. In other words, most of the classical schemes that we use, say, to evaluate an integral to 8, 10, or 15 digits, very quickly run out of steam when we need hundreds of digits. So there are a couple of exceptions. As it turns out, if we have a continuous function that's completely regular, even at the endpoints, then no sign of any singularities, even in higher derivatives, then just regular Gaussian quadrature actually works quite well. There's a problem there we'll mention in a minute, that the beyond for very, very high precision, then you see the cost of computing the abscisses and weights becomes prohibitive. But otherwise, it's quite usable, and we often use it. The real winner, though, that we found is this one that was found by way back in 1973 by Takahashi and Mori. It's often called the tan-sinh scheme. And it's really a pity this is not very well known. I haven't seen it yet in any commonly available numerical analysis textbooks. And it's, you know, but yet it, from what we have seen, it's just what the doctor ordered for, particularly for computing high precision values. So just as a quick overview, what the tan-sinh scheme is rooted in what's known as the Euler-Maclaurin summation formula of numerical analysis. If any of you have studied numerical analysis, almost certainly you have seen this at one step here. And basically, the Euler-Maclaurin formula writes an integral as a finite sum plus some higher order correction terms. And in fact, if you look at the first line there, the first line really amounts to the trapezoidal rule. Or so you can really think of it that the Euler-Maclaurin formula is the trapezoidal rule plus some higher order correction terms. So if you think for a minute, what would this Euler-Maclaurin formula here tell us about a very special class of functions such that the function is zero at both endpoints of the interval, and in fact all higher derivatives exist and are zero at those endpoints? It's sort of like a bell-shaped curve that goes very rapidly and then really rapidly to zero at both endpoints. Now again, this is admittedly a very, very special class of functions. So, but for that class of functions, what does the Euler-Maclaurin formula tell us? Well, poof, all of these higher order terms disappear. And so basically, what that's saying then is that for that special class of bell-shaped functions, the ordinary trapezoidal rule is extraordinarily accurate, and in fact will work very well in practice in getting high precision evaluations of the integral. So you'd say, well, big deal, you know, the function I want to integrate is not one of that very, very special class. So here is the genius here of Takahashi and Mori. was to say, let's do a change of variable in this integral with this very strange function, the hyperbolic tangent of the hyperbolic sign. And lo and behold, that has the property of converting almost any reasonable function that you can write a formula for into one of this special class. And then we just apply this, the trapezoidal rule, and it's proof. We have a very accurate and rapidly converging approximation to the integral. And in fact, what you get up the upper right corner here is you just write, it just amounts to, it's a computational rule. All it amounts to is you pre-compute some weights, wj, and abscisses, xj, which are just directly computed from that formula. And then that's completely independent of the function you want to evaluate. So it's just like, for those of you who have done Gaussian quadrature, it's the same thing. You calculate abscisses and weights, and then you can integrate whatever functions that you want. And what's really nice about this is that not only is it very good for regular functions, but even functions that say that blow up at the endpoints or have vertical derivatives, for which schemes like Gaussian quadrature just utterly fail and fall apart. Tansinch works for those just fine, almost without any difference. It's not like it runs slower or anything. It just doesn't seem to care one way or another. It runs every bit as well for functions that have singularities as those that don't. And here's just an example. Here's a function, minus log cosine, that blows up rather badly at minus 1 and 1. And after we do this substitution with this tansinch function, this is what we get. And indeed, this function goes to 0 on all of its derivatives at the endpoints there, or for large enough abscissa values, and just a normal, after the substitution, just a normal trapezoidal rule works very well. So in effect, or in other words, once we compute these abscisses and weights, we apply that to original function, that's basically the equivalent of the scheme, and it works very, very well. Here's just one interesting example. Here is a function. When I first saw this that was trying to evaluate this, I thought, oh, well, I'll just use Gaussian quadrature because this is completely well-behaved. And indeed, when P is 3, Gaussian quadrature worked very well. It got hundreds of digits of accuracy after several iterations. But when P is 3.5, it just wouldn't, it would never get beyond about 5 or 6 digit accuracy, even with a very fine mesh. And so I thought, what's going on here? And kept looking for a bug in my code and didn't find one. Finally, I just used tansinch, and it immediately, evaluated it to hundreds of digits accuracy with, very little computation. So I was trying to understand this, why was a function that is very regular in appearance, why couldn't Gaussian quadrature do this? And the reason is that this function is regular, including at the endpoints. Its first derivative is regular. Its second derivative is regular. Its third derivative is regular. But the fourth derivative on the right-hand side blows up. And because of that, Gaussian quadrature falls on its face. So again, it's just sort of, to me, a testament of the value of this tansinch scheme, that even for functions that look good, the classical schemes often fail, but where the tansinch essentially works for anything. Here's just one example of one of the first applications that we did with this. John could tell you more about this. This was some work with himself and a British physicist, David Broadhurst. They were looking at some studies of quantum field theory, and this particular identity, or the conjectured identity, or this integral, arose from volumes of knot complements in hyperbolic space. And some initial analysis suggested that it might be equal to this L series evaluation, which is a shorthand for this expression. So we thought we would numerically check this result. And so I computed this integral to 20,000 digit accuracy. And the right-hand side, we were actually able to just use Mathematica to evaluate, also the 20,000 digit accuracy. And they perfectly agreed to 19,995 digits. So we were willing to write off 5 digits for numerical error and claim victory. It's interesting, though, this function within the realm, the interval of integration, has a really nasty singularity. And so it doesn't really satisfy the conditions that we normally, you know, apply these schemes. So what do we do? Well, it's easy. You just break this into 2 integrals, one integral from the left margin to the singularity, the second integral from the singularity to the right margin. And the tangent scheme was able to handle both of those integrals with ease, and we got our result. Subsequently, we might add that this is actually there is a proof in the literature for this result, although we didn't know it at the time, actually. Anyway, so as it turns out, though, higher dimensions integrals, we can extend these methods just by normal iteration to higher dimensions, but unfortunately that gets very expensive very fast. And so we just mentioned this is an unsolved area. We really, really would like to have some better schemes for obtaining very high precision integrals in high dimensions. This is a very nagging problem for us, because we have all kinds of very juicy applications that we're sort of stymied on because this is starting to become computationally intractable. Here's just a few examples of this. Here's some problems, again, which were referred to us by some mathematical physicists. And here are 3 classes of integrals. And again, as you can see, these are iterated integrals. What can we say? Can we apply these methods to these integrals? As it turns out, in the first example, we were able to actually, by a clever substitution, reduce this to a one-dimensional integral. And these, even though these are very complicated functions, our the tangent schemes work just fine, and we're able to compute these. So I just computed a whole set of these to like 1,000-digit accuracy. Very quickly, we're able to derive some of these and prove some of these results that we show here. But what was most remarkable is that it became very quickly evident that the C constants for large N approach a limit. Do I have time to actually run a... This is sort of an amusing example here. I'm going to actually do a live demo here. Okay, is that showing there now? Okay, so here is this inverse symbolic calculator. And so here, if my paste still works, here is the limit, at least to about 50 digits, of those C sub n's. Actually, this was like the value of C sub 1024 or something like that. But it converged at least to this level. And so when I discovered this, is exactly what I did. I pasted it into the inverse symbolic calculator, and poof, there it gives a result. This is very likely equal to the square root of 2 squared, otherwise known as 2, divided by e to the gamma squared, in other words, e to the 2 gamma. And indeed, that's the case. And we were able to prove that. I remember when I discovered this, I was just so elated that my wife was just, I was at home and my wife just came in from the garden and I was telling her about this. And she said, well, gosh, that really is a remarkable result, you know, coming out of a computational or a mathematical physics problems of all places. And she said, well, why don't you go present that at a conference somewhere? And I said, well, there is, in fact, a number theory meeting going on at out at Monterey, the Sylmar, this weekend. And before we could, sanity could prevail, we packed our bags, we're in the car. I called the conference organizer on my cell phone, said, there are any slots? He said, yeah, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. I said, fine, I'll take it. And got a hotel reservation, and next morning I presented this result. Now, normally you would never in the world, you know, if you got some mathematical result, you know, present it so soon after you had found it, because you'd want to spend weeks, if not months, and poring over all of your derivations to make sure that everything's sound. But, you know, here, when you numerically find a coincidence like this, it's not exactly something that you can fake. But anyway, nonetheless, and we were able to actually, within actually a few days, actually able to prove this and show that, in fact, this 2e to the minus 2 gamma is really just the first term of a very interesting asymptotic series that would give the C sub n's for all n. Here are just a few more results that we got. Now, notice that the D and E integrals we cannot reduce to just one dimension. We really had to do these as multi-dimensional integrals, and they were beastly expensive in computer time. But nonetheless, we were able to obtain the results we show there. I might mention this E5, that I put a question mark there, because unlike the other results that we've presented here, we have not yet even now been able to find a rigorous proof for this. Not even sure how to start. But nonetheless, in fact, this is the result that I showed. Remember at the beginning I showed this PSLQ plot that with the drop? That was actually the PSLQ run that discovered this E5 formula here. And as it turns out, to do that, we didn't actually evaluate a five-dimensional integral. Actually, this formula here for E sub n is actually of degree n minus 1, which would be four dimensions. But we also were able to find a tricky transformation of this that reduced it to a three-dimensional integral, and that was really what we computed. However, that three-dimensional integral is exceedingly complicated. Here is actually the one that we, the formula that we evaluated. And so this is a really nasty, it's not just algebraic stuff. You see here, there's a, right where my arrow is, there's a log, there's a couple of logs actually, and it's just a very, very complicated function. And just transcribing this from a mathematic expression to a working computer program that would be using some of our quadrature tools was pretty tricky. Nonetheless, we're able to do this, able to get 250-digit accuracy, and then we discovered this formula here. Rather striking application of this PSLQ and the high-precision quadrature. And again, we put a question mark on it, although we're, as I mentioned, it holds to at least 200 digits beyond the level that one could reasonably ascribe to like numerical error or random chance. So we're really quite confident, even though we do not have a formal proof. Here are just a few more results. We also looked at this two-dimensional family of constants, where we put a k plus 1 in the exponent in the denominator instead of just 2. And it turns out this family of constants has a very interesting property, that there are linear recursions in every row of that two-dimensional array. And here are just a few of the ones that we initially found. Subsequently, we were able to develop this into a whole theory. John Borwein and Bruno Salvi were able to, you know, completely understand this phenomenon here. Again, a few more results in terms of hypergeometric functions for some of these C constants. Here's one example. Here's one example of a two-dimensional integral that we had to evaluate in this. And this is a follow-on study here. And notice here that this function is singular on all four sides of the region of integration, and with the particularly nasty singularities on the closest and the furthest corner. In fact, if we first tried, we weren't able to evaluate this. But after just a simple transformation that sort of unzipped those two troublesome corners, we were able to evaluate this using a two-dimensional tan-sinh. Although we still were looking at a function that was singular on all four sides of the domain of integration. So here. Another study, again, from mathematical physics, some Heisenberg spin integrals. These are interesting because they underscore the cost of doing these in increasingly high dimensions. In dimension two, we were able to compute that integral to 120-digit accuracy on just one processor in 10 seconds. By the time we're up to six, as a six-dimensional integral, to even get six digits required 59 hours running on 256 processors. So, you know, it's this high-dimensional integration is really a pain. Yeah, the equivalent of several years on a single processor. One final application, again, which is completely exploded here, and we got many, many, many results, both theoretical and, or both general and specific, when what we call box integrals, which are essentially multidimensional integrals based on the distance function. So you can think of this as like the average distance between two points in the unit cube, or the unit n cube, or with other related distance metrics. And so you might think, oh, surely such a simple and basic fundamental problem, this has been studied to death. Not really. It turns out there's a lot of, besides other than just the very first couple dimensions, really nothing was known. And so, again, we were able to apply some of these methods, and this delta 3 sub minus 1 we're actually able to reduce to a one-dimensional integral. And again, we calculated this. And in this case, I just literally threw on the right-hand side here a whole bunch of terms, just completely guesstimation, kind of based on some previous work, but kind of not. And then just with a hope and prayer that we would find something. And indeed, PSLQ did find a relation, this one that's shown here. And so this actually then launched a very, very fruitful paper that we've just recently completed, a very long paper with many, many interesting results. And here is just a very quick summary of some of these results that we got here, just in the next few view graphs. I cut this short because there are many more that I'm not showing you here. Then finally, some random walk integrals that John just very briefly mentioned in his talk that we've just started to look at, and again, already got some very interesting results, and we think this will again be the first step in a very, very interesting study that with a lot of results that we obtain in these methods. So just one, before we quit, there's one bucket of cold water I want to throw on this whole business. Here is just an example that even now just makes my hair stand on end. Here is an integral that we looked at, and computing this integral to high precision is pretty difficult. And I think actually Greg Fee helped originally in doing this. doing this computation. When we first did this, we thought, that's pi over 8. And indeed, this is equal to pi over 8 to over 40 digits, but is provably not equal to pi over 8. And in fact, very recently, Richard Crandall really uncovered the mystery of what's going on here. He was able to show that, in fact, we can write pi over 8 as an infinite series, shown here, and this integral up above is merely the first term of a very, very rapidly convergent infinite series. If we take the first term, it's accurate to 40 digits. It's equivalent to pi over 8 to 40-digit accuracy. If we take two terms, then it's accurate to, I think, more than 800 digits. Three terms, probably haven't done it, but probably more than 10,000 digits. And but again, I think it's sort of an interesting moral to the story here. One, it's a reminder that the computations, no matter how compelling, do not constitute formal proof. We still have to do a lot of proof the hard way, although a lot of times it's easier if we can be confident our result is correct. But secondly, even in such a case, it isn't just capricious numerical chance that these are very close. There was an underlying reason that we can discover if we try hard enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mermix?
Peter.
It's Peter Bohr wearing a Dermex. A comment, first of all, that I should have made in the introduction. It shows from David's talk there's nobody with more expertise in high-performance computing on supercomputers than David. And while his mathematics is terrific, it's not his day job, in fact, which is remarkable. The second question is more philosophical question. I guess the first thing wasn't a question, it was a comment. So you look at all of these formulas that have been discovered. I think there's any chance that we'll eventually be able to essentially machine-proof them all, as well as machine-discover them?
I think eventually, sure. I mean, Moore's Law goes on, and but, you know, eventually maybe 100 years, I don't know. But I think that it's already interesting, though, as John mentioned in his talk, that some of these identities, these infinite series identities that we discovered, we were able to discover them using PSLQ and both as the specific forms and then extrapolate to the general forms and then prove them using Wilks-Auerberger. And so I think these two schemes really complement each other well. The PSLQ is very good for discovering identities, isn't much good for proving them. Wilks-Auerberger is great for proving identities, it's not much good for discovering. And so they meshed these two tools as an example of entirely computer-based tools that mesh together very well, taking us everywhere from the discovery of a result to at least a machine executed proof. And so I think it's, again, that these integrals that I've shown, this is a completely different realm, but in the end, what are we doing is we're working out these proofs. We're doing sequences of operations, and in many cases, these are assisted by, like, Maple or Mathematica derivations. So, you know, to some extent, we're already halfway there because we're using Maple and Mathematica, their symbolic capabilities in doing these proofs.
Are there other questions from Ermix? Toronto? Let's thank our speaker again.
Okay, thank you.
to remind you also that lunch is provided today by Ermex and should be outside here shortly.